Good morning, Your Honors. Just before I begin, I would like to take a moment just to apologize in advance and ask for your patience in my voice. And if I begin coughing during my argument, I don't mean disrespect, just recovering from a little respiratory situation.
If you also excuse my bloody nose.
That's a deal, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Neethi Pawar. I am representing the appellant, Ms. Catherine Mullins. She's present in the courtroom as well. My registration number is 24729, Your Honors. As you know, this appeal stems from a dissolution of marriage action from the lower court, trial court. We are appealing that portion of the permanent orders that addresses maintenance. As Your Honors are aware, the maintenance which was awarded in this case was in the amount of $9,000 per month for a period of 3 months, which then automatically reduced to the amount of $3,000 per month, continuing for just over 8 years. We are appealing specifically that automatic reduction in maintenance after 3 months from $9,000 to $3,000 per month. We are asking the court to vacate that automatic reduction because we believe it is not supported by law, it's not supported by the record, it was a reversible error by the trial court, and we are asking that that be vacated today. Our briefs obviously address a request that we are making for attorney's fees as well, in addition to an award of the survivor benefit related to a particular pension. In my limited time today, I would advise the court that we will be focusing on specifically that automatic reduction. We believe that if this court allows the order and that automatic reduction to stand as it is, it will result in a couple of things. First of all, it effectively guts the legislative intent of the Colorado Maintenance Statute by disregarding the controlling precedent, which requires the court to consider and provide under only very narrow circumstances under which automatic reductions of maintenance may occur.
The statute doesn't apply here.
The statute?
The new statute?
Well, the legislative intent of the maintenance statute overall.
Okay.
The new statute does not apply to this case. That is correct. But I believe that the maintenance statute as a whole and its legislative intent, the pre-January 2014 statute,
okay,
it does provide for certain remedies available to Ms. Mullins, how we deal with long-term marriages, how we deal with non-monetary contributions to long-term marriages when a trial court decides the amount and duration of maintenance. And the case law provides specifically the very narrow circumstances under which an automatic decrease is authorized. The second thing we think that will result if the court allows this order to stand is that it effectively preempts and obfuscates the whole entire purpose of the maintenance modification statute, and that's 1410.122. So starting with the first problem of several, as you know, that we have, the circumstances under which maintenance may be automatically decreased. The case law is very clear, it's set forth in Falwell, that if the trial court is going to enter an automatic reduction in maintenance, it must be tied to a specific ascertainable event, not a future speculative event. That did not happen here. The trial court did not say, now after 3 months, I'm going to award or order an automatic reduction because. So we are left to fill in the blank. So that's speculation number one. And we believe that that alone is grounds to vacate that automatic reduction.
But if the record supports the reduction, whether the judge made a finding or not, we can still affirm it, correct?
Your Honor, you've been reviewing my notes.
No.
We do believe that, for the sake of argument, I think that there's probably sufficient reference or an assumption, an extrapolation could be made. I think other extrapolations and assumptions could be made, but that one is one of many that could be interpreted. If we proceed under that assumption, that automatic reduction is tied to Mr. Mullins's change in employment status, okay?
Well, so, for which there was record testimony.
There was testimony that there was an anticipated, speculative, expected change in circumstances. So A, we don't know what it was tied to. Assuming for the sake of argument, it's tied to his employment change. The only things that we factually know, that we actually know as facts that existed at the time the trial court entered permanent orders, is Mr. Mullins was employed earning $27,700 per month. Ms. Mullins was unemployed. She had been out of the workforce for over 5 years. Ernie, nothing.
Wasn't there testimony that she intended to go back to work at something like 3 years into that would meet the same date of the reduction?
Your Honor, there was testimony about Ms. Mullins's ability to gain future employment, to be gainfully employed in the future, and what that range of income looks like. The facts as they existed at the time the order was entered, she was unemployed. The third fact that she was unemployed at the time that the order was entered. The third fact that we know is that simultaneously with the automatic reduction by two-thirds in maintenance, Ms. Mullins was ordered to move out of the marital residence, so she would not have a home. So now we move forward to your question, Your Honor, that if we assume that it's tied to his employment status, the change itself is speculative. Mr. Mullins is very careful throughout his briefing to qualify when he references that change, that he says it's an anticipated or an expected change. So it was a temporary project, that we know. This brings us now into our third level of
speculation. The job was going to end in 3 months.
The job was anticipated to end. Temporary positions convert to permanent positions in this field all the time. We don't know. This is our third and most troubling level of speculation.
So cutting to the chase, your position is you should have left the maintenance alone, and he should have come back 3 months later and moved for a change in maintenance based on a change in conditions. 3 months later.
Very close to that. I don't believe that 3 months would be sufficient to meet the modification of maintenance
burden.
That's
the problem.
Well, that's the problem for Ms. Mullins. That's why this order is error, Your Honor, because it doesn't afford Ms. Mullins the same protections as everybody else who receives a maintenance award. Basically, what the trial court has done here is said, Mr. Mullins says, gee, Your Honor, in the future, I might have a change in circumstances, and so go ahead and just change it now. Don't make me prove a continuing and substantial change in circumstances such that it renders this award unfair. Don't make me go through my burden of proof. That's every single case in which the trial judge enters a maintenance award, that we don't know what might happen in the future. That's why the modification statute exists, to provide the payor spouse that remedy. That doesn't exist here. Here's my argument with respect to the speculativeness of what's going to happen at the end of 3 months. If something happens, Mr. Mullins, his position may continue at a permanent level, same income level. He may obtain new employment at a higher income level. Again, remember, his income was close to $900,000 a year. This income, the temporary project, was around $350,000 a year.
Well, hold on a second. Hold on a second. What it seems to me what you're saying is she could have come back if he did find a higher paying job, if he did end up getting a much higher paying job after that 3 months, she could have come back for modification of maintenance, but she can't because the period is too short. All right.
I'm saying two things, two reasons I disagree with that, Your Honor.
Okay.
One is the modification of maintenance statute is not available to a spouse merely because an increase of the payor spouse's income.
Well, that's what I was getting to. Because the payor's income isn't even a factor in the setting of maintenance, except for the reason, can the payor afford to live on the income that he has? It doesn't make any difference if he makes $1 million a year, if the judge finds that her reasonable needs are $9,000 or $6,000, the judge has discretion. That's where he has to set the maintenance. It doesn't make any difference what the husband makes. It makes a difference what the wife's needs are.
And you're correct, unless the husband argues an inability to pay, which is what he has done in this case. He is arguing a future speculative inability to pay. He's saying, I won't be able to pay in 3 months because my job will end. We don't know if it'll end. He might be earning more substantial income. Even, Your Honor, if he obtains replacement income within a couple of months, that would not be sufficient to meet the modification standard under Section 122, 1410.122. And that's why this order is problematic. So if he earns lower income, but he's still able to pay, the mere fact that it's lower income is not sufficient to modify it. So it should not be tied to an automatic reduction. If, Your Honor, he's offered a position and it is comparable income, and he just voluntarily turns it down, Now we're back in the boat of he's voluntarily under or unemployed. Ms. Mullins has no ability to make that argument. This, all of this is entirely removed from her, her ability to come before the court and say, it hasn't been continuing, it's substantial, or it's still sufficient to meet his reason, his ability to pay, or he's voluntarily underemployed. The reason, Your Honor, is because all of this is speculative. And this ties into what I was saying about the speculativeness of what will happen. Why are we all assuming that he would have no income or he would not have the continuing ability to pay? That there's no evidence of the record of that. We don't know what's going to happen months from now. Mr. Mullins had never been without income throughout the duration of this marriage. And this ties back to our overall overarching big picture of the inequity of this outcome. Because it was Mr. Mullins's voluntary decision to leave that employment during the dissolution process that created the scenario. So the only way to remedy, which has no prejudice upon Mr. Mullins, is to vacate the automatic reduction. And if he then, after 3 months, his job circumstance does change, and he has the ability to come to court and say, I now have an inability to pay, my circumstances have changed continually and substantially such that it renders the original award unfair.
Did the judge make a finding of the wife's reasonable needs?
No, Your Honor, the judge made very little findings. It's very difficult to ascertain. Everything we're doing, we're trying to get in the judge's head to try to figure out what he tried to do here.
If the judge found that her reasonable needs were $6,000 a month, we'd have no reason to hear this point, would we?
I disagree. Because the $6,000 a month, there is no discussion about her housing expense. She's homeless after 3 months, Your Honor, and this is again part of the problem where there's no, at the same time the automatic reduction of maintenance happens, she's homeless. So this is immensely problematic. Your Honor, we believe that I'm at 3 minutes, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes.
Let me just ask a question about the widow's, the MLB pension widow's benefit.
Sure thing.
The judge didn't take much consideration of your post-trial motion. He apparently felt that he had assigned the entire retirement benefit to the husband and there was nothing separate to argue about. Had you argued, or had the wife argued, in the permanent orders proceeding that she should get the widow's benefits separate from the pension itself?
That's my understanding, Your Honor. I wasn't the trial court attorney. My understanding is that there was an argument that first of all, the survivor benefit is not property. That doesn't have a value to Mr. Mm-hmm. Mullins. So it's more like an insurance policy. And if the court reviews In Re Payne, P-A-Y-N-E, it was a similar argument where the court says, look, this is basically an insurance policy for the estate that's awarded to the non-participating spouse. And we're asking for, given the investment of 32 years during this marriage, supporting the breadwinning spouse by moving all over the country, raising the children, and managing the home, we should at the very least get a survivor benefit.
There's no stipulation on that, though, was there?
Well, we believe there was a stipulation if you review the record and the trial court. And in my brief, I refer to the transcript where there is a discussion about the stipulation and where it's mentioned in the pleadings in the joint trial management certificate.
Stipulation consisted of the husband saying, I don't care if she gets it or something.
Something like that.
But there was no formal stipulation.
Your Honor, I believe it was mentioned in the trial management certificate. I'd have to review it just to be certain. But I do believe that there was a change of heart post-trial, only after the motion was filed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I think you have a little time left, but I'm not sure.
A couple of minutes.
A minute and eight, I think. Okay. Counsel?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Blaine Myrie. I'm a counsel for Respondent Appellee, and registration number is 23329. Counsel? I think, Judge Richman, you hit the nail on the head when we talk about this income issue. Now, I think one of the things that it's argued in the brief and that I think was less emphasized in counsel's opening argument was this notion of voluntary underemployment, which is a factual finding, as the case law holds, typically a factual finding. And here the trial court did not impute income. It did not find that Mr. Mullins or Mrs. Mullins left their employment in bad faith, and that is supported by the evidence in the record about the condition that Mr. Mullins was under when he was working at IHS, the 3,500 hour years, the stress, the lack of resources. So that's a supported factual finding and has to stand, which means there is no imputation of income. So the discussion of Mr. Mullins' income really just devolves around to that one section, as Your Honor noted, of 1410.114.4F, where you look at the payor spouse's income and ability to meet his own needs and satisfy the maintenance award. Beyond that, it really doesn't have any application. Now, in terms of the discussion of reasonable needs, there is not a specific finding of reasonable needs in the record. However, there is evidence to support the finding that the reasonable needs were $6,000 a month. You have the testimony from Mr. Mullins. You have Exhibit 117, which is at page 210 of the suppressed PDF. You have the trial court's express rejection of the wife's expert analysis, which had pegged maintenance at $9,000 to $12,000 a month and was the basis for her claim of $12,000 a month in maintenance. The trial court expressly rejected that and said it tended to agree with husband's criticism of that. And the criticism of that was severalfold. Number one, there were only 4 months of data involved. And number two, the expert himself did not actually analyze the underlying expenses. He simply took the numbers from the wife's sworn financial statements and applied them. So there was no independent analysis. Mr. Mullins, on the other hand, had managed the family finances for 30 years. He's an accountant. He has experience with the family expenses, and he went through and analyzed the expenses and demonstrated to the court through his testimony that the reasonable needs were about $6,000 a month. Now, how that shakes out with regard to the necessary findings, there is case law out there from the state Supreme Court and from this court that says you do not have to have an express finding. The Marriage of Udis case that we cite in our brief notes that in that case upheld a denial of a motion to terminate maintenance and notes that that order that it was under review did not expressly recite the needs or expenses of the parties. And yet the court upheld it because it said there was evidence presented of the parties' expenses and their incomes. That's the same case here. We're not requiring trial courts, at least under the old statute. The new statute, it doesn't apply. So under the old statute, the trial court, unlike in a child support case, the trial court is not required to make the sort of detailed findings that certainly would be helpful, but they're not required. And that's what the Udis case says, and also the marriage of Page case cited in our brief was a similar situation where the court ironically upheld a $3,000 a month maintenance award where there was the court noted that that award was based on an implicit determination of the wife's reasonable needs. And I think that's the same inference that can be drawn here. The court expressly rejects Mr. Tenbrook's, the wife's expert analysis, and instead looks to what the husband says is the reasonable needs based on the evidence in the record, and that was $6,000. Now, in terms of the proposal, the proposed maintenance being reduced from $9,000 to $3,000, this comes straight from the respondent's trial brief. If you look at the exhibits PDF, and this is specifically at page 105 of the exhibits PDF, the husband describes the situation with his job, the $27,000 a month from Digital Globe that was set to end in January of 2014. The actual offer, signed offer from Digital Globe is also in the record. I believe it's Exhibit 87. I don't have the exact citation, but it is in the record. And that specifically said that it would end, the job would end as of, here I have it here, it is page 890 of the suppressed PDF. And that says, is an October 2013 offer that says the anticipated project end date is January 30th, 2014, but it may be slightly sooner or later. That is the type of evidence that I think is reasonable for a trial court to rely on in making determinations surrounding a maintenance award. And I don't think that it is speculative to say that, or to require a court to then reserve jurisdiction and have another hearing 3 months later where they probably rehash a lot of the same evidence and people arguing about, well, you have this extra income, you don't have this extra income. There is some flexibility that the trial courts have to fashion an appropriate maintenance order. And the notion that what's called an automatic reduction, which I would call a reduction based on the evidence in the case, has been upheld in other cases. You have the Sim case, which is cited in the briefs, and in that case you had maintenance being reduced to $1,000 every 3 years until the wife reached 65. And in that case, this court said that we perceive no difference between limiting the duration of maintenance to a specific term and awarding incremental decreases in maintenance before terminating.
Was Sim based on a specific event that was going to occur? We had to do with the wife getting training, if I'm not mistaken. Or a presumption that the wife would get treated.
Your Honor, it was. I can't recall specifically the facts of the case. I know the case you're talking about. I'm not sure that's the Sim case, but there are cases where it's recognized. But I think similarly here, what you're looking at is the various factors in 114.4, and if there's going to be a known change in that, then it's appropriate for the trial court to take that into consideration rather than, as a matter of judicial inefficiency, requiring the parties to come back to relitigate the issue, in this case, 3 months later.
Do you agree with the wife's counsel here that what the court did was apply, I guess it's 110F, implicitly applied 110F, by saying the husband's ability to pay is going to be different after 3 months? That's in a sense what he did, right?
Yeah, I believe so, and I believe, Your Honor, that's based on what the husband's trial brief, where it's expressly said that the income will jump and the ability to pay $9,000 a month is there.
And the husband, after 3 months, when the husband's ability to pay changes, In a case generally, he would have the right to come back in and seek a modification of maintenance, would he not? Which is, I guess, what counsel for the wife is suggesting should have happened here.
Well,
procedurally, he could have done that.
Procedurally, absolutely. Yeah. But I think the question is he required to do that? Are we required to force the trial court to say, no, you can only enter one number, and then you have to either reserve jurisdiction or the husband has to come back in under 122, have an additional proceeding later to do that? It smacks me that that is judicially inefficient and not judicial economy.
Well, conversely, can the wife come in under 122 and seek a modification increase because his needs did not go down?
Well, the wife can come in and seek an increase anytime that the maintenance order is
unconscionable. Right.
And is it a higher standard? Yeah. Yes. But is it not unconscionable? I think, you know, looking at the totality of the circumstances here, she's getting the $3,000 a month. Her reasonable needs are $6,000 a month. At least the record supports that finding. She also received $1.5 million in property and assets, including substantial investment accounts that presumably have, at least in this market, some reasonable rate of return. Mr. Mullins testified to that in the record. There was some cross-examination on that, so the parties put that evidence before the district court. And in determining the amount of maintenance, the court is required not only to take into account husband's income and wife's reasonable needs, but wife's property. 114.4A specifically instructs the court to consider the financial resources of the spouse seeking maintenance, including, and the statute is specific on this, including the share of the marital property that the wife, in this case, obtained. So the court absolutely takes into consideration the fact that she has received substantial resources from the marital estate. And that is part and parcel of why this is not an abuse of discretion. The totality of the circumstances justifies a finding that the reasonable needs are $6,000 and that $6,000 can be met through a combination of $3,000 a month maintenance, the financial resources at the wife's disposal, and her own testimony in which she admitted that she could make $45,000 a year and that she intended to be working in January of 2014, which was a few weeks after this order was entered.
Is there anything in the record that suggests the court took that $45,000 potential earnings into account?
The court did make a specific finding that she thought she could make $45,000 for full-time employment. It's, I believe, paragraph 12 of the findings of fact where that is found. So the fact that the court makes a finding on that at least indicates that the court was aware of it. Now, does the court make the leap and say, I think she's going to make this? No, it doesn't, but I don't think that is required. I don't think those kind of level of findings are required.
He does not impute income to her, so to speak.
No, he doesn't impute income to her, but he can take into consideration her future earning capacity under 1410.114.4b. You take that into account in determining whether how much maintenance to award and the duration of the award. Briefly on the widow's benefit. The widow's benefit was something with both parties in their competing proposals said wife can have it. But the trial court...
The husband said the wife can have it.
Absolutely, that's what was said. But
it happened.
There is no stipulation on the record that says wife gets this. And so it was something that was left to the district court to decide. The district court can decide it. Is it a benefit to the husband? The husband, you know, may have another use for the survivor's benefit, that he may have a different survivor that he wants to give that to. But the fact of the matter is, number one, they say they're not challenging the property division, in which case this issue goes away. But if they are challenging it, it was not an abuse of discretion. The court could have awarded it to either party.
And there was no suggestion during permanent orders that the court should sever the widow's benefit from the MLB pension itself, was there? Argument for anything wasn't raised till post. I just don't know.
I don't recall. I think there was the competing proposals. There was some debate about the value of it between Mr. Mullen's analysis of it and the expert.
The pension as a whole, but pension as a whole benefits separately.
That I don't recall, Your Honor. I honestly wouldn't want to mistake the record, but in any event. It was not an abuse of discretion to award it to either party, and in this case, it was awarded to the husband. So I don't see how there's a reversible error, regardless of who it was awarded to. And then on the attorney's fees issue, there's no requirement that a party or that the court make findings of fact when it denies a motion for attorney's fees. So if there are no further questions, I will cede the balance of my time.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel for Mrs. Mullins. Ms. Mullins has about a minute eight.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Just briefly, in my very limited time, we have a 32-year marriage. We have two parties. The trial court is treating them as equals, giving them each the same amount of property division, and then they go on their separate ways. Ms. Mullins makes minimal income, and she has no housing expense that at the time of permanent orders, and then will have to incur a housing expense once her maintenance is automatically reduced. She will have to live off of her minimal income and live off of the assets that were awarded to her. Mr. Mullins was awarded the same property. He has the capacity to earn $1 million a year. So while we're focusing on what Ms. Mullins may earn in the future, the same inquiry applies to Mr. Mullins. His capacity to earn is immense in this case. It's the driving factor. So to just say that, gee, the court didn't impute income to either party, and gee, they both have the potential to earn, does not properly consider the totality of the circumstances. These parties are not on equal footing, and the automatic reduction is tied to a speculative future outcome. I ask you to ask yourself if Mr. Mullins' income did not decline after 3 months, is this order fair? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. Counselor excused, and opinion will issue in due course. This brings us to the end.